and welcome to another episode of Right Now, a podcast on the craft and business of writing presented to you by Broadleaf Writers Association based in Atlanta, Georgia. On this episode, we're going back to the round table. Tonight, I am joined by Broadleaf board members Harmon Slaughter and Jessica Bowers, who writes as Odessa Blaine. Hello, ladies. How are you tonight?
Hey,
Well, doing great.
Doing all right.
I have liar. I have thoroughly enjoyed doing these roundtables, and one of my favorite parts of it is that we get an opportunity to shine a light on board members in addition to talking about writing. So I'm going to give the floor to each of you and give you a moment to tell us a little bit about your writing journey and what brought you to the Broadleaf Board of Directors. And Carmen, as the longest tenured, you draw the short straw.
Okay, I can do that. I actually was introduced to Broadleaf when I was asked to be a moderator for the conference. And I did that, I think, a year or maybe two. And after that, I was like, this is a great organization. I love it. And it wasn't very difficult for you guys to ask me to become part of the board because I saw so many amazing things happen at the conference. It seemed like a very healthy, comfortable, and warm space for writers at any stage in their writing journey, very interactive, and a wide range of types of writers. And the question and answers, no one was made to feel like stupid or inept. Every question was a valid question. And I just really love the energy more than anything. And I didn't know all of the board members, but after like 1 year being on the board, it feels like family. So I just love being a part of it. It's one of my favorite things that I do.
Yes, and definitely like family. You're not going anywhere in my life, so you're kind of stuck with me now. So
well,
just sort of deal
I'm
with
glad to be stuck.
All right, Miss Bowers,
I feel
about
better
you?
Than I like most of my family.
I can't argue that.
Yeah.
This is one of those things where, like, you know, as a writer, one of the tropes is found family. This is most definitely our found family. And I know there are all kinds of sayings about that, but I think I have discovered that, and this is no shot to my real family, it's just the truth, that the found family I have in life, I have a much deeper and stronger connection to than my own family, which could be a statement about me. It could be a statement about my family. It could be that I just really meet awesome people.
I think it's one of those things. What's that saying? Water seeks its own level. I'm probably saying that wrong. I never know where it came from. But when you find your people, your village, and everybody's kind of at different stages of the same journey, and we all love the written word and literature so much, and we just want everybody to be good and to have that opportunity to continue to write. Of course, we're going to cling to each other because it's that support that you sometimes don't get from family because maybe they don't understand what it means to be a writer. And they were just like, oh, you just sit down at the computer and it's no big deal. But then other writers are like, yeah, no, that's not how that works.
Not how that works at all. And we do want to get back to the sitting down and writing part. But before we do,
yes.
On to you, Jessica.
And that's so if mine started with a Facebook ad, I was feeling really, you know, that imposter syndrome was under my skin. And I was working on a book for like 10 years. I was like, I'm never going to finish this book. Nobody's ever going to read this book. It's crap. I'm crap. It's all crap. But I happened to see an ad for the conference a few years ago at a moment of weakness. And I immediately bought a ticket because I said, if I go ahead and invest in it, then I know I'm going to go and we'll just see. And at that point, I had already tried to dip my toe into a few other communities and I had had not great interactions there. I wasn't thrilled with the family I was finding there. That was not the family I wanted to be in. So I came to the conference. It was a virtual that year. I didn't submit to First Pages because I was terrified. And then I got talked into doing a reading at like the little virtual get together they did after the conference that day, and I read the first little bit of the book I was working on at the time. I have never in my life felt that supported, that cheered on. I had people in the comments cheering me. I had people messaging me. I had people message me afterwards. It was the most welcomed I think I've ever felt in my life. And I decided I had to be part of this community. And I bugged the crap out of Zach, telling him about all the skill sets I had. And finally, he was like, well, we could use some help with the marketing. You want to come and help with the marketing?
Well, I will
Yes,
tell you.
and then I handed you the social media reins and walked away.
But also, for all of us who were on that Zoom, when you read and you, I think you probably said something about being nervous or it's probably no good. And when you read, we were like, what is she talking about? This is amazing. And then I think Zach told us that he had been in contact with you, but then we're all like, does she want to be on the board? We want her on the board. We need her on the board. And it, you know.
Yes, it had
And now you
quite the
can't get rid of
impression on
me.
everybody. That's right. Yes, because we're trying so hard.
But it was just like a unanimous, we need her and we want her on the board. It was almost like, do you think she liked us? I hope she liked us.
That's right.
Plot twist, I did. I really did.
Yes. We were trying to figure out who was the cool kid in that equation. It turns out we all were. So,
Yay.
yes. For the only
The only
time in
time
our
in my life
lives.
I've been the cool
Yes,
kid.
for the only time in our lives, right? Yes, I know. I definitely have not been the cool kid before. Anyway, so butts and seats. I wanted to chat with you guys about the sitting in the chair to write part of writing, and what it takes for you to do that. How good are you at it? What do you have to do to, like, sometimes I have to actually trick myself into doing it. I will acknowledge that. Like, I have to give myself some other reason to sit in the chair, and I go ahead and open the document, but I gotta do something else. And then I'm like, okay, after about like 15, 20 minutes, I'm like, oh, okay, I'll just go back and peek. And then next thing I know, I'm writing. So, that's one of the things I know I have to do, but how difficult is it for you to get yourself into the chair on a consistent basis?
You want to go first?
I don't. How's that? I dream of being that person that has the routine. I dream of being the author that has this is I'm going to get up at 4:30 a.m. and write for 2 hours and or what, you know. I am not that person. I will for like 2 weeks, a month and a half, I will write diligently every day and I will knock out like 3,000 words a day and then I won't write again for a month. So it's like a manic episode for me when I write.
For me, I don't have a problem sitting in a chair. The problem that I have is staying focused on what I'm supposed to be doing as opposed to what I shouldn't be doing, which is going down rabbit holes. But what has started to work for me more now is I do set a timer. And I don't think about how many words, I think about how much time. So when I have breaks, which those are few in my life right now, but when I have breaks, I'll say, you're going to write for 30 minutes. It doesn't matter what it is, you're going to write for 30 minutes. Typically, that will lead to an hour, sometimes more, but I have to make myself view it as this is a task I have to do at this time of the day, or else I won't. And sometimes it's really good flow. Sometimes I'm just typing words and deleting words and retyping words. But the consistency of making myself do at least 30 minutes a day, as opposed to I'm going to watch TV, I won't turn the TV on and I'll say, give yourself 30 minutes and then you get to watch TV. And it's helping a lot because before, with what you were saying, Jessica, I'm not going to get up at 5 in the morning. I'm just not. And if I do get up at 5 in the morning, I'm not going to sit down and write for an hour. I'm a night owl. So a lot of my 30 minutes ends up being at the end of the night after I've done all the other things and I kind of want to go to bed, but I'll say, you stayed up later than this for other stuff. You can stay up and make yourself work on your art. And so that's what I've been doing that, and it's helped a lot to just make myself. Whether it's good or not, I can't say.
Yeah, I
If
can't
I
do. I'll agree with you on that. I cannot do the 5 a.m. I mean, I get up at 6 a.m. every morning anyway, but that getting up has to involve having coffee and at least digesting some news slash entertainment for like 20, 30 minutes so that I can get myself going and then get ready for my work day. I've had to actually start recently making my lunches like really defined time and making it a working lunch so that I'm eating and working so that when I take the actual break, whether it's 30 minutes or an hour, that I can actually write. 'Cause I like food and I want my lunch to be about my food. So if I can't eat and write, then I need to eat and work and then write. And then most of the time it involves starting, like, I know there are people who say you shouldn't do this, but this is another way that I get myself going when I'm not feeling it. I go back and read 3, 4, 5 pages of what I last wrote. One, because I want to get back into the flow of it, but also I guess I've reached a point in my writing where it makes me feel excited to keep going. And then I want to create some more words. So, that's more of the trickery I've had to employ to outwit myself.
I always do
What
that. I
I'm
always go back
hearing
and
is
read a little
that
bit.
I'm hearing that we are all not so much plotters.
Okay, but
No, I'm a
sometimes
plotter.
I trick myself into I'm a planter. I do a little of both, but I will sometimes the tricking, you talk about tricking yourself. Sometimes the tricking comes into I will go into my notes and I've created these amazing notes, like this whole timeline. The where the roots tangle, I cannot tell you how many different iterations of that timeline because I would make it and then I destroy it. But going back and like fixing the timeline and then writing to that timeline and then going back and fixing it again the next time, that actually helped me because I was like, okay, well, I didn't like the way this was going, so I've got to tweak it here and I've got to tweak it there and I've got to do it right now while it's in my head or I'm going to forget where I'm going with it.
I actually love the editing and revision process, but for me to actually create the draft version of my manuscript, I have to have a very thorough and detailed outline with any dialogue that I've come up with at that point or I'm feeling in the moment. I have to put it down in that outline, and it really breaks down everything that's supposed to happen in the scene and why. And
Ooh.
I think that's just because my brain functions better if I have a plan and a list. I mean, if I go to the grocery store for four things, I have to have a list in my hand. Because I need that structure. I need to know what to expect. I think I would probably lose my mind if I tried to write a novel without having a plan in place. I mean, like I said, I love going back and reworking and editing and stuff like that. But I do so much editing as I go because I have that thorough outline that I don't really get to a situation where I have to like rewrite vast portions of the book.
Oh, lucky you.
I know, right?
Right?
Well, all it
Yeah.
takes is a whole lot of anxiety and need for routine. You know, it's fine.
Okay, well, I have one of those things.
Because for me, I actually do a lot of editing for people. And that is one of, I think, the downfalls. I'm good at it, but then when I'm working on my own projects, it's a obstacle. It's like a roadblock because I'm like, I can't. Oh my God, no, Carmen, you need to go back. And so I'm doing myself a disservice because I do have such a strong editor mind that when I'm writing my own things, I find myself challenging myself. And that's not. I don't like being my own nemesis.
could see where that would be,
Yeah.
you know, a good and a bad thing, because a lot of folks don't have those strong editing skills. So, you know, there was a lot of things in mine that I completely changed some major points and had questioned myself on it. And when I sat down with a really good editor, they were like, "Hey, this feels like it should be a thing." And I'm like, "Oh crap, that was a thing." And I took it out.
Overedited. Well,
Yeah.
that kind of leads to a question though. And I haven't mentioned this yet, but you have a book coming out through Mercer Press and Mercer University Press, where the roots tangle. And congratulations first and foremost.
Yes, congratulations.
Yes. But I guess there's two parts of this. One is a question and the other is a get ready for this other part. The question is, as someone who has a book that's coming out, that you have the deal with it and everything, how does that make you feel about your future projects?
I think that is a loaded question, but
Yes, it is a loaded question.
I think it makes me feel so it first of all, it's a little validating. So it makes it a little easier to look at these next projects because I know that I clearly did something right at least this time. So then the question becomes, can I do it right again? And I think where my writing style is successful is my use of detail, the way I kind of pull very visceral descriptions and make the reader feel like they're experiencing it with my main character. So as long as I can keep doing that, I think that the rest of my stories are going to be strong too. At the same time, there is a pressure now. So, you know, is the next story going to be good enough? Is it going to be, you know, and I say that having not even put this story out there. There's just been a
Right.
limited number of people who've seen it and say it's good enough. And I trust those people, but at the same time, there's that little part of me that goes, is it though? Is it?
Well, if Mary Kay Andrews can sit after 30 plus novels and say that she sits down every time writing, feeling that she's not good enough, then just get used to it. It's just that's just a feeling we never lose, apparently.
Yep, this
I
is a
know
good
I was
vibe.
actually what was going to say beyond that was, as you refer to yourself as a planter, that the next thing that you get to do then is to pitch your next story idea to your editor. I'm assuming that they have some type of option, you know, first look option kind of thing.
They did. They asked to have first option. Yes.
Yeah, first right of refusal. So that means that for them to consider it, you're going to have to write a very long and detailed synopsis of what that story is for them to consider whether or not they want to sign you to another contract. So just,
So
you
weirdly enough,
know.
that's going to be easy because I've
Oh,
already got the next three books
okay.
outlined, and
Okay.
I've got 10 to 15,000 words written on all three of them. So honestly, it's one
Okay.
of those where which one do you want?
Okay, gotcha. Okay, then you are prepared for it.
So can
Too
I
much
ask
stuff
you?
bopping around in my
Yeah.
head.
Can I ask you a question then about the others that you kind of already have in the pipeline that you can offer them?
Sure.
Are they similar to the one that's going to be coming out, or are they
Yes.
vastly different?
Well, I wouldn't say, okay, yes and no. Because it's the Weatherroots Tangle is a Southern Gothic and it's got elements of folklore and magical realism and all of these things kind of being tied together. The other three that I'm working on, one of them is more of a modern Gothic. It also has magical realism. One of them is a almost dark fantasy meets Southern Gothic. And then the third one kind of crosses the line into more horror. And it will be a stretch to necessarily call it Southern Gothic, other than the fact that it's just set in the South and it's got some Gothic-ish elements. So the answer is yes and no, which is not an answer, but there you go. That's the one you get.
No, it makes sense. I just wonder because you know how sometimes when someone has their first book, and everyone loves it, and I'm sure everyone would love yours. Then you're like, the next book has to be this too. And then with some of our local writers who started out in one genre but were secretly writing in other genres and having to switch over and also bring their fan base along. I think you will instill that type of trust in your readers anyway, that like if it's your book, it's gonna be good. But I just wondered if, because you do so many things, I don't know when you sleep, by the way. I wondered if they were at all similar.
Insomnia.
Same here. But yeah, well, that's good to know then.
Yeah. So I think that fans of Where the Roots Tangle will enjoy the other stories too. There'll be enough similar elements there. I don't necessarily want to pigeonhole myself, but at the same time, I'm very comfortable in the Southern Gothic world. I enjoy it. My first novel that y'all were initially introduced to was pure fantasy. It was fantasy fiction, nothing Southern about it, and that thing has been shelved. But and I don't know that it'll ever see the light of day. But it is vastly different from where I've ended up going as an author. But I think being part of Broadleaf has kind of helped me be more comfortable finding where it is that I want to be as an author, finding my voice, finding my genre. I pigeonholed myself until I realized there was more out there than just the fantasy world that I had kind of lived in for so long.
Yeah, see, I'm kind of on the opposite track of that, is that I got The Weight of Ashes out there because of a fantasy project that I had. And what I really want to be doing is in that area, fantasy, this fantasy series that I've been working on. But in the meantime, I now have two books published as literary fiction, and it's not where I ever wanted to be. I've often said that life is real enough. I don't want to write about it. But whatever gets the books on the shelf, I
Right.
guess.
Right. Yeah.
Well, in your first one, The Weight of Ashes, I enjoyed the heck out of that. Like you say that wasn't where you wanted to be, but you wrote that so well. Like you took
Thank
us
you.
on that
Appreciate
journey,
it. I
and I
appreciate
was invested.
it. Yeah. I
Yeah.
appreciate it. I mean, and I don't say that to belittle either of them. I think I'm very proud of both books, and I'm working on, the next one in that line. And that's fine. I mean, I enjoy writing. I want to tell stories, and wherever those stories can find print and be given to readers, yeah, I mean, that's what I want to do. My heart is just still in my fantasy project, and that's where I really want to be. But if that never happens, at least I have a path. And that's not a terrible thing.
So I'm like entirely embarrassed to admit, Carmen, that I haven't really read a lot of your stuff. I want to hear more about you. Tell me you. Tell me
No,
your stuff.
that's my
Please.
favorite answer. Well, so I have three projects that I'm working on. One is strictly a romance novel, the other is creative nonfiction bordering on hybrid memoir, the more I work on it. And then the third one is a biographical fiction. And the thing that really threw me for a loop is that when I was talking to someone about it and the time period and everything, they were like, oh, so you're doing historical fiction, but it's like the 80s. I'm like, oh no, oh
Sadly,
gosh.
that's considered historical fiction. Because I
Oh
mean,
my
if we have to
word.
start doing math, we're going to get into a number that begins with four, and
It's
that's so unfortunate.
yeah. So, and my heart is really in the literary, creative, nonfiction, hybrid memoir that I think I have pretty much created my own subgenre. It's what I've been working on the longest and I'm the most passionate about, but the other two are much easier to write. But as we go back to talking about, and that was kind of why I asked you that question, as far as are they similar? I'm thinking if I finish this one and somebody wants it, if they ask me what do I have next, none of them are the same. And so do I get an audience and then lose them because they're like, we really loved that romance. We don't want to hear about this other stuff. And so what I have set a goal for myself is to finish one of which I won't say in public to have it ready for the conference.
Okay. All right.
Now, okay, so
I was gonna ask, if you had to write three books in one of those genres, what would it be? But obviously you've made your choice and you don't want to say it, so that's
yes.
fine. So what were you gonna say about it?
I was going to say, like, so sometimes when I'm doing the marketing consultations with authors and they've written in multiple genres, they're really scared of losing their audience. And what I tell them is, it depends on how you frame the marketing itself and how you talk to your audience. As long as your previous audience doesn't feel forgotten, you'll have some of them that are going to stick with you because they are fans. They are diehard fans. They adore you. And then you have some of them that are going to be like, okay, I love this. I didn't love this one so much. I'm still going to pay attention to what you're doing in case you write something else that's closer to this other thing. As long as you're not making them feel neglected in your messaging, you're not going to lose that audience. You're going to gain the other audience too. So it's a bit of a juggling act and it can be difficult, but it can be done.
And there
That's
are a lot of
helpful.
crossovers. I mean, that's how we ended up with romanticy.
Exactly. Yes.
You have your romance readers and you have your fantasy readers, and it's natural. Actually, I was having this conversation with somebody today because it's such a natural bridge because, they're both escapist. They're both trying to find some other world scenario, whether it's the perfect love story or, the perfect world, whatever it happens to be. And those tend to merge well. Probably a lot more better than
Professional words here.
if I'm going to be grammatically correct, than say horror and romance, which would be entertaining.
Would
But
that
I don't know.
be more ranted? No.
I don't know how I was trying to think of what that is. Horrance? I don't know.
Horrance. Be very careful when you
Romor.
say that.
It's
You might need to
Romor.
like beep that out.
Because you can definitely get,
Romorance.
horrantasy.
Horror. Yeah, if you have horror, fantasy, and romance.
But yes, it's a lot of fun to play with these blending of genres though. And I think honestly, as we're talking about this, I have been in a war with myself about which story do you want people to read the most versus which story do you think will be easier to get published? And that is what kind of like what you were saying as far as your heart is in a fantasy, but you've published two other books that are literary fiction. So the story that has had the longest hold on me and the more investment of like time and energy and research is the one that I'm like, can this even be published when I know for sure that the romance could get published?
Which
And
I
then
mean,
the other
which
one.
one fuels you more though? Because I feel like there's plenty of people who get success writing to the whims of the market, and I don't want to like hate on them at all. But we've got to write the stories we want to read. We've got to write the stories that we're most passionate about. And I feel like when we do that, it comes out on the other end. Like your readers are going to tell which one you're most passionate about.
Yeah, I agree.
See that's the thing though, is that okay, so I'm most passionate about fantasy. And if I had a contract for that series, I would probably giggle for a week. And knowing that I would be able to live in that universe and write those stories that I've had in my head for a very, very, very long time. But with The Weight of Ashes and Perfectly Normal, that's not at its core something that I'm passionate about. Those aren't the books that I tend to pick up if I want to read, though I do, I mean, from time to time. So I have to find the thing about them that I'm passionate about. With Weight of Ashes, it was walking down nostalgia into the historical time of 1989, going through pop
Ugh.
culture and remembering what it was like to be a kid at that time and, delving into folklore and then tapping into grief that I was experiencing. And I could make that a thing for me. And with Perfectly Normal, it's kind of the same process. Like, it's not a story I would gravitate to as a reader, even though I've said I will read it from time to time. But I had to find the things in it that I was passionate about.
With and this was something else that Broadleaf brought to me. I've always been fairly eclectic, though I've gravitated mostly toward either historic fiction or fantasy. And once I started hanging out with y'all, I met Robert Gwaltney, and he had the Cicada
Mr.
Tree.
Gwaltney.
Yes.
And I read the Cicada Tree and I realized, and then it was, a Southern Gothic, and I was like, and it had magical realism. I was like, I love this. And that's really where I was like, I want to write stories like this. And all of these stories that I had been keeping in my head and not making notes down or anything, that's when they started kind of pouring out. And so to an extent, being exposed to other genres and being part of a community like Broadleaf is really good for that, because you get to meet so many different authors from so many different genres and mixes of genres and everything. You get to kind of dip your toe, and it helps you find which pond you want to be swimming in.
I
Definitely.
had that happen with just reading, because for the longest time I don't think I knew what I wanted to be as a writer. I was all over the place, and then I was introduced to Terry Pratchett, wonderful British fantasy writer, and I realized two things. One, like, oh my gosh, I want to write fantasy. And two, I want to take all of this humor and put it into everything that I write. Which led to a couple of books from a small press that I had out first that were very satirical, but I think I found the balance after that. But yeah, so I mean, it's fun to have that discovery. You had yours with Broadleaf. I had mine just as a general reader. But yeah.
Yeah, I read so widely that it does help me with the conference specifically to sometimes, even though I have been given the gift of first pages, so I don't get to moderate as many panels as I used to. I'm actually excited that I get to do another panel this year at the conference. But a lot of the times I would pick a panel that had writers on it that I was unfamiliar with. So then I was kind of forced to read out of my comfort zone in preparation for the conference. And it led me to a lot of books that I never would have just walked into the bookstore and picked up. And I enjoy the first pages piece of it because I get to see what people are writing. And we have a lot, always so much fantasy. And that helped me look for fantasy that would appeal to me, because I think most of the fantasy that I read is not like deeply into the fantasy world. It's kind of the books that we had to read in school that were labeled fantasy. But it's such a wide variety of fantasy out there now. And so it's made me delve into a genre that I didn't really ignore, but I just was like, oh, maybe there's nothing there for me, when in fact there actually is. So.
Yeah. You mentioned first pages, and I know for the first year or two that you did that, I was always mindful of not wanting to talk about like pigeonholing writers into a genre. I didn't want to pigeonhole you into being the first pages person. But I think it was like year three that I realized that it wasn't one of those things where we'd pigeonholed you. It's more like we had actually lost access to it, and that Carmen just took it over. It's like it became kind of like, over my dead body, will you take this from me, kind of thing. So I'm glad that you have a second panel that you get to do, but I'm also glad that you're still doing first pages, because I know how excited you get about that.
It's so
What's
fun.
nerve-wracking when you have somebody reading your so I submitted Where the Roots
Yeah.
Tangle, and I was nervous to have somebody else read my work out loud, even if nobody else knew that that was my work. You did a beautiful job. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
She does what most people don't with first pages, and she actually reads them through before
I
the
do.
conference. Like, so she's ready for them. Because there's so many times that there's stuff in their words that you have to, like you might trip over if you don't actually haven't actually read it first. But yeah, no, you do a masterful job of that. My first pages experience was with James River Writers in Richmond, and it was actually for what would become the first book I had published, but it wasn't at that time that it did. And my first page was read by Clay Chapman. And
Oh,
the
wow.
if you've ever heard Clay McLeod Chapman do a reading, you'll understand when I say it was not a reading, it was a performance. And it actually changes even more so the way you hear your words to see somebody putting that much energy into it. But that was quite a first experience for me.
See, as a performance storyteller, I love that. I love it. I think all stories have to be performed, even when you're just
Yeah,
reading them off the page.
I tell, and I know I've probably said this to you before, both of you before, because I brag about him all the time. But I think one of the most impressive things I've ever seen, and we'll call this a preview for the 10th annual Broadleaf Writers Conference because Clay is going to be there, was I saw him in Richmond at the Poe Museum, reading one of his books. I think it was The Remaking, if I remember correctly, and he had the book open. But he had memorized it. He had practiced it for like 6 months because he's a performer. And he performed a very large portion of a chapter of his book. Like he would mindlessly kind of flip because he knew when to flip, but he wasn't ever looking at it. He had just remember he just memorized the entire thing. And it was such an incredible experience to see that out of a writer, because most definitely not something that is common with writers.
So what I
Does he
want
do?
all the listeners to know right now, because Clay is such a well-known name, he's got so much published, he has such personality. When he and I had a conversation, when I was complimenting his marketing presence and the way he puts himself out there, he communicated to me that he stays nervous about all that, that there is an element of imposter syndrome too. So I just want everybody out there who's
Yeah.
like, but Clay is Clay and he's amazing. Yes, he is, but he's also just as scared as you are.
I, if you watch his social media or have ever heard him read, you have a very different impression of Clay than what Clay really is. And so yeah, I think when you have the opportunity to meet him in person, you get it's manic, but it's also still very subdued. It's very calm because yes, he still suffers from that just like we all do.
Yeah,
So,
he's gonna be in Chattanooga this weekend
oh,
for yeah. Can't go.
I know, and I have to be in Chattanooga this weekend, but for something else, and I didn't know about the festival, and I think he maybe even posted about it last year when he was there, and I was gonna try to remember so that I could get passes and attend, but I missed out again, so I put a note in my reminders to look at the date for next year so I don't miss it. Because A, I love a film festival, and B, who doesn't want to run into Clay and whatever he might be doing?
look, this is
So
rounded
yeah.
into a Clay McLeod Chapman appreciation hour.
Yes.
I'll have to pass that
Now
along to him.
we love
Yeah,
him, but
we do.
yes.
It's impossible not to. I mean, he's very lovable. But time is a very strange thing, especially when you're doing a podcast and we are at the end of ours. But before we run out, I always like to wrap up my conversations, or at least it's something I've been doing this year. I like to wrap up my conversations with a question about mental health, because as a writer, predominantly what we do until we start working with editors and other people, the writing process is very solitary, and it's us versus the people in our heads, and it's us versus ourselves with imposter syndrome, and it's us versus the expectations we put on ourselves to write this much or to finish on this particular time, or it must be, this is our definition of successful. And it can lead us down some dark roads. And the question that I like to ask is, what do you do to help address those issues? Like, how do you manage your own mental health as a writer?
Well, first of all, I'm very neurodivergent. I'm also bipolar. Like, it's depression is a thing. I fight with myself a lot. And what I have learned to do finally, after many years of conditioning myself, I've started making myself talk to me the way I would talk to you, the way I would talk to my friends and the people I love and the people I care about. And that also bleeds into when I start bullying myself, what would I do if somebody was bullying somebody I loved?
Right,
And
you beat
that's
yourself
how
up.
I've dealt with that. Yeah, sometimes it's a knockdown drag out, man. But I try to make myself talk look like what I talk like when I speak to my friends and to, those people who are supportive of me too.
Like that.
Well, interestingly, I do the same thing. I will, but I don't really talk to myself in depth. But what I will say is give yourself the same grace you would have others give themselves. And so I have like a, it's over there, so I can't get it, but it's a little thing that just says grace. And so I look at that. But then the fun thing that I do when I feel myself spiraling downward is I put on line dance tutorials on YouTube and I dance it out. It's the
I
truth.
love
So
that.
that's what I do. Because who doesn't have fun dancing? Even if you dance poorly, it's still fun. And so I put on YouTube line dance tutorials and I'll dance until I get tired or feel better. And then I go back to it. But I've been doing that for about a year and a half now. And it also counts as exercise.
I'm having this really, really vivid image now of like the Broadleaf team together doing line dancing with Carmen leading. And
I
I don't
dance
think
so
I
poorly. It'd be a
do not
comedy
think
show.
look, I know thinking of every single person on the board that there's not going to be a lot of pretty dancing happening. We're going to bring new meaning to dirty dancing. But I think it's an image I'm not going to be able to get rid of.
Well, we could probably make that happen at the conference.
We could certainly try. We have a new Saturday night expedition. All right. Well, I hate to do it, but we are up against it. But as always, it's wonderful to chat with you both. And I do want to say thank you for all that you bring the organization, all the passion and energy that you have for making this a vibrant community and helping other writers. Had an enormous impact, and I greatly appreciate it.
Well, we thank you for being our leader, and I love you couldn't get rid of me if you tried.
Well,
But
I'm not
you
going to be trying. So I haven't tried yet. So if after 7 years I'm not going to try, it's just not going to happen. All right. Well, thank you both, and best to you. And I look forward to our next conversation.
All right.
Thanks,
Thank
Zach.
you.
Thank you.
And thanks, Carmen.
Thank you. See y'all
Thank you.
later.
All right. Bye.
Bye.